Hello and welcome to The Wire, where we have independent coverage of current affairs on your local community radio station all around Australia. I'm Roderick Chambers in Sydney, and coming up on The Wire today...
I don't think the Premier's been doing enough. I don't think the New South Wales Health Minister's been doing enough to engage with the federal government about the rollout of the largest vaccination program probably in the state's history and the country's history.
On the weekend, the first AstraZeneca vaccines arrived in Australia, and phase two of the vaccine rollout can now proceed. However, there seems to be a few problems between state and federal health authorities on exactly how these vaccines will be distributed. Also on the program...
But to have a jacket is indicative of very high social status. This is the elite only.
So these were the Aston Martins and the Lamborghinis of Pompeii.
I'm not sure if that's a precise analogy.
A magnificent Roman chariot has been discovered near the ruins of Pompeii. It's an exceptional discovery, and we find out just how good it is. Stay tuned for all of this and more coming up on The Wire. 2 years of damning evidence has come to a head today with the release of the final recommendations on the Royal Commission into Aged Care. There is a dreadful litany of failures in aged care facilities, government and non-profit organisations, and it remains to be seen what the government can do to fix this broken system. Mark DePauli has the story.
Australia's elderly has long suffered in aged care facilities and at the hands of service providers. The Royal Commission into Aged Care Quality and Safety has brought the situation to public notice, and since 2018, the sector has been observed and scrutinised. Whilst not all of Australia's aged care workforce are underprepared, the deaths from COVID-19 of aged care residents were at one point the worst of any country. Ian Yates is the Executive Director of COTA Australia, the leading representative voice of elderly Australians, and he described what the Royal Commission's process has been to this point, which has led to today's final release.
They spent the first year really focusing on what is the problem and how big is the problem and what's causing it. And that then led to their interim report, which was titled Neglect. They've obviously held a large number of public hearings at which they've had both users of aged care, family members, advocates like myself, academics and other experts, and bureaucrats and so on appear before them. They've circulated draft recommendations and sought responses to those. And then they've held a final hearing in October last year.
That final hearing was the draft for today's 148 recommendations put towards the federal government. Prime Minister Scott Morrison spoke this afternoon, reminding that this situation is the fault of governments from the last 30-odd years, including his own, but acknowledged the need for generational change. According to Dr. Catherine Barrett, founder of non-profit organisation Celebrating Ageing, this is a trend that extends beyond just facilities and service providers. Rather, it is the entire nation's disregard of our elderly.
What's happening in residential aged care reflects the attitudes in the broader community. Our ageism and disrespect for older people means that there is insufficient funding, there is insufficient remuneration for staff, we're not adequately training them. The benchmark is so low that our ageism and disrespect for older people in Australia is so widespread. There's not really been accountability for the disrespect and the issues, particularly in aged care, that we need to address.
Dr. Barrett is passionately working to bring light to and fight sexual abuse, particularly of elderly women in care facilities. And the road ahead for people like her is one that the federal government must acknowledge and work towards fixing.
There's no compulsory training on sexual assault. For the last year, there were 950 reports of sexual assault in residential aged care. KPMG found another 1,700, so it's over 2,500. And up until this point, there are no strategies to respond to prevention of sexual assault of older women. Older women in particular are sexually assaulted in residential aged care by other residents and by service providers and sometimes by visitors and family members.
Yates and COTA Australia are expecting some of the changes to give more power to consumers so that their care is specific to their needs only.
A new Aged Care Act that provides rights for people receiving aged care. how much of that and gives them more control, how much of that then flows through into, say, how the program is managed. We need a huge amount more transparency about how providers operate, the quality control, staffing, funding. All those things are essential. They've been recommended time and time again, and they are being recommended again by the Royal Commission.
According to Yates, there are great service providers in Australia, but they are unable to grow despite longer waiting lists due to the government's current regulations. These service providers can be identified as those who care for your loved ones most.
Those providers tend to be providers who are more engaged with their customers and their families. What they look like, however, are providers that are regularly very full, that people can't get into, and that are constrained from expanding.
Yates is not expecting all 148 recommendations to occur overnight, but expects as much coordination and communication between organisations like COTA and the government as there should be between aged care consumers and their service providers.
We want a clear timetable from them with clear deadlines to which they can be held accountable about when they will deal with each of these things and when, for example, we will no longer have a rationed home care system, when they will put more money into the system so that then everybody can make a plan about the future.
Ian Yates, Executive Director of COTA Australia, speaking there with Mark DePauli. Bathurst Regional Council has come under renewed pressure to reconsider their decision to build a go-kart track on a Wiradjuri Sacred Women's site. A recent motion in the New South Wales Parliament has accused the council of failing to properly consider the voices of traditional owners and unanimously supported the cultural significance of the site. Track is set to begin works next Monday on Mount Panorama, the iconic motorsports venue. Sophie Ellis has more.
Wiradjuri traditional owners are urging Bathurst Regional Council to reconsider their decision to build a new go-kart track on a sacred women's site. The proposed track is located on Walu, otherwise known as Mount Panorama, and is currently set to begin works on International Women's Day next Monday. The site was approved for development by Bathurst Regional Council in 2019. Though the project has garnered support from the Bathurst Aboriginal Land Council, Wiradjuri elders from Wiradjuri Traditional Owners Central West Aboriginal Corporation say they have been consistently opposed to the site since its initial proposal in 2018. Bathurst Council maintains that it has undergone appropriate community consultation in selecting a location and stressed the historical significance of the site in Australian motorsports history.
With Bathurst and with our heritage of motor racing, it's an $85 million asset nationally, it's $27 million to the local economy. We don't want to lose that.
Councillor Warren Orban says the heritage report investigated by the council found no significant archaeological evidence to support the cultural significance of the site. The traditional owners said in a statement to council that they will not stop until each and every legal means to stop the cart track being built on a sacred women's site is exhausted. Mount Panorama has been an active motor racing site since 1936. The indigenous significance of the site far outdates its motor car history. Walu is a site of significance for Wiradjuri people, a key link to dreaming stories and several ceremonial sites, including the women's site in danger of destruction. Auntie Leanna Carr-Smith from the Wiradjuri Traditional Owners Central West Aboriginal Corporation explained the area is a place where women are said to have handed down their sons to men for tribal initiation. This is our grandmother's and our ancestors' place, she says.
Okay, so the Rights of the Indigenous People, the UN Declaration, says that Indigenous people can practice their own culture and self-determine. We subscribe to those as a country, those declarations, yet it seems to be lip service when it actually comes down to upholding them.
Joanne Byrne, co-chair of the Indigenous Rights Council at Australian Lawyers for Human Rights, says Bathurst Council is failing to act in accordance with the UN Declaration of Rights of Indigenous Peoples. She says Bathurst Council are blind to the condemnation other cultural destruction, such as the Juukan Gorge, has generated.
At the end of the day, I think they're just out of touch with reality. Look what happened in the Juukan Gorge. Yeah, Section 10 may, legally say you can go ahead and put your go-kart track here, or you can go ahead and you can destroy this gorge by blasting it. It's not morally right. It's not culturally right. And the backlash that comes from it, you would think the council would have seen what happened to Rio Tinto with that gorge.
Bathurst Kart Club said in a statement that they are entirely comfortable that the appropriate actions have been taken at all stages of this development, and that it will capitalise on Mount Panorama's reputation as the spiritual home of Australian motorsport. Councillor Warren Aubin says that Mount Panorama is a significant economic contributor to his community, and the processes undertaken to consider cultural significance have been adequate.
There has been open forums in council for people to come along and state their case, either pro or against the go-kart track. If they didn't like the idea, they stated their case. If they were for it, they stated their case. So it has been open and transparent. There's been no doubt about that.
Joanne Byrne says that the irony of the site's destruction aimed for International Women's Day is not lost.
I just think the council just hasn't no regard to Indigenous anything with it. It's on Women's Day. It doesn't matter what day.
She says the cultural heritage of the Wiradjuri people should far outweigh the legacy of a go-kart track.
A go-kart track, like, what is that going to be in 10 or 20 years' time? Or 40,000 years' time from now? How is that go-kart track going to affect our heritage? Or what would they think it will it?
Joanne Byrne, co-chair of the Indigenous Rights Council at Australian Lawyers for Human Rights, ending that report from Sophie Ellis. This morning, New South Wales Premier Gladys Berejiklian told reporters that she didn't have enough information on the vaccine rollout from the federal government.
I would appreciate, of course, as much timely information as possible from the federal government. We won't know yet beyond week four how many doses New South Wales will have.
Zach De Silva spoke to New South Wales Shadow Health Minister Ryan Park about this latest development in the vaccine rollout and asked what's really going on.
Well, it's not good enough. 6 weeks or so ago, we called on the New South Wales government to have a plan within New South Wales about how they would roll out the vaccination. And obviously, we expected them to be talking regularly with their federal counterparts. We now appear to be informed that that's not the case. And the community have every right to be really angry and really upset that in the middle of a pandemic, politicians at the state and federal level seem to be playing political games, not getting on with the job of rolling out this important vaccination program.
So who do you think that fault here then? Do you think it is the state government not requesting enough information from the federal government, or do you think this is a case of the federal government withholding information?
Well, New South Wales Health and the New South Wales government, given that we are the largest health provider in the country, one of the biggest in the world, should have been sitting down with the federal government and their agencies some time ago and outlined how they could use New South Wales Health facilities, resources, how we could use the Service New South Wales app, what New South Wales government could bring to the party in terms of rolling out this vaccination. Because what we need at the end of this is the majority of Australians vaccinated in the quickest time possible. And we don't get that if we see the very slow rate of vaccination and the hiccups that have occurred over the last week or so.
So you're saying then in terms of the Premier's comments this morning, you don't think that she's been doing enough?
I don't think the Premier's been doing enough. I don't think the New South Wales Health Minister's been doing enough to engage with the federal government about the rollout of the largest vaccination program probably in the state's history and the country's history.
I mean, we're seeing the same kind of thing happening in Victoria this morning, the Victorian Health Minister making similar comments for more transparency from the federal government after there were those 25 vials of the Pfizer vaccine thrown out. Surely some of the blame for this rests at the foot of the federal health department.
Well, absolutely it does. And the reality is, though, the people on the ground, whether it's our frontline health workers initially, our elderly people initially, those with immunodeficiencies originally, and certainly those with compromised immune systems, they're the ones who are suffering by not getting this rolled out as quickly as possible. And what I'm saying is very simply that the largest health system in the country, the size of ours, should have been engaging, I would have thought, with their counterparts in Canberra long before we start to have discussions now, a week after the rollout's meant to have commenced.
In terms of, I guess, other aspects of the COVID-19 vaccine rollout, there's been a lot of talk lately of ring fencing around confirmed cases in terms of vaccinating close contacts of confirmed cases and trying to stop the spread that way. Do you think that's a viable strategy to contain COVID-19?
Well, I think if that's what our health experts are saying is something that we should be looking at and doing, then certainly that should be the approach. I know, and I agree with what the Premier has said in the past, that if we get spikes, we need to concentrate very rapidly, very quickly on vaccinating around those spikes and the community members most closely related to those people, as well as the broader community in that area. I think that makes sense. But to do that, we've got to have a strong partnership and relationship and dialogue between the Commonwealth Government, who's responsible for the overall rollout, but also the state government, who has the largest facilities, health workers, hospitals in the country. And that's why I certainly would expect, as a community member, I'm sure most community members expect, that dialogue should have been happening some time ago between the state and Commonwealth governments.
Ryan Park, New South Wales Shadow Health Minister, speaking there with Zach De Silva.
Hey there, I'm Hamish McDonald. Around Australia, you're listening to The Wire. Take it easy.
South Australia is leading the charge in a state ban of single-use plastics. The state legislation comes into force today after a three-year inquiry. Environmental Minister David Speirs says that the legislation will prohibit the sale, supply and distribution of single-use items, such as straws and cutlery. Nathan Nikolich asked Greens MP Mark Parnell how the transition away from single-use plastics would be beneficial for the environment.
Well, anyone who's ever been to the beach or anyone who's ever been to a creek or a river, you cannot fail to have noticed the amount of plastic rubbish that is there. Now, there's lots of types of plastic rubbish, but there are some items that when you look at them, you think, you know, it's all unnecessary, but some of it is really unnecessary. And at the top of the list were things like plastic drinking straws and plastic coffee stirrers. They're all products for which there are readily available substitutes. So the government has at least started the ball rolling with banning single-use plastics by starting with straws and coffee stirrers. But, you know, we've got a long way further to go. We've got to get to coffee cups. We've got to get to takeaway food containers. There's a lot more to do. But straws and stirrers were a start. The environmental benefit, less use of non-renewable resources, in particular oil, and keeping this stuff out of the natural environment, in particular our oceans.
Obviously, the ban of single-use plastics is a step forward in the right direction, but what more do you think should be done to aid in the facilitation of a more sustainable future?
Well, when it comes to consumption, the way we consume things, getting rid of single-use throwaway plastics is a really good start. It doesn't mean you can't have disposable products, but if they're made of compostable material, cornstarch, for example, you often see that at music festivals and those sorts of events where the plate and the knife and the fork and the spoon and the food scraps all go into the same bin. They all get composted, you know, turned back into a valuable product. We've then got to look at packaging, and supermarkets are a classic. You know, the idea of four apples on a little foam tray with sort of cling wrap over the top, you know, that is quite bizarre. You know, why do we put up with that? So I think there's going to be a combination of outlawing, like banning certain practices, plus consumer awareness and, you know, trying to get the public on side and saying to the supermarkets and the other shops, no, we don't like the way you're presenting these you know, packets and boxes and whatever. You know, we want the packaging to be more sustainable because we're worried about our impact on the planet. So it's a long-term process. But what you've got to remember is that you've only got to go back, was it probably 60 or 70 years, we didn't have plastic. You know, almost nothing was made of plastic. Yeah. And society did quite well, you know. Now, there's no doubting the convenience of plastic, but I think we'll do well in a post-plastic environment too.
How long do you think it'll take for there to be a complete ban of single-use plastics statewide?
Well, in South Australia, the very first day is, you know, 1st of March. The government has said within a year there's going to be other products banned. I think the progress could be quite quick. you know, businesses in South Australia have seen the writing on the wall. They know that these items are going to be banned, and they know that it's their food containers and Slurpee cups and all manner of things. And the point is that there are alternatives that are sustainable. Even, you know, clear plastic drinking cups can be made from cornstarch. You don't want to put hot liquids in them, but for cold liquids, there are biological sort of alternatives that are biodegradable, compostable, look the same, perform the same as plastic, but don't cause any problems in the marine environment, because when they break down into the natural paths from which they came. They don't break down into microplastics that just end up polluting our rivers and creeks and ocean.
Greens MP Mark Parnell speaking there with Nathan Nikolic. Illegal digging in Pompeii has helped unearth an intact ceremonial chariot, described as an exceptional discovery by the Archaeological Park of Pompeii. Decorated in bronze and iron, the chariot, the Lamborghini of Roman transportation, was found in the portico of an ancient villa to the north of the official historical park. Wendy Searle asked Dr. Craig Barker, archaeologist and manager of education and public programs at the Chow Chak Museum at the University of Sydney, what the significance of the discovery was.
It's incredibly significant for two reasons. One is the level of preservation, the nature of the destruction of Roman cities of Pompeii and Herculaneum in 79 AD with the eruption of Mount Vesuvius. Meant that there was an incredible amount of preservation of material culture, of ancient Roman artefacts, in a way that we don't traditionally get in Roman archaeological sites across the Mediterranean. So the fact that this particular metal chariot, this four-wheeled chariot made of iron, bronze and tin, is in such good condition is one thing. The other thing is, on top of that, that we actually know very little about transport and modes of transport. And the fact that this is not just a chariot used for transportation, but it actually seems to be some sort of ceremonial chariot, some sort of processional chariot, gives us some insight into that elite and higher social status aspect of Roman society.
Well, the chariot, it was decorated apparently in iron elements and bronze decorations. Was this usual?
What it's indicative of is just the incredible skill of Romans in terms of metallurgy and in terms of crafting metal. The fact that you've got incredibly decorative elements on something which is ceremonial, it's meant to be seen, it's meant to be beautiful, it's meant to be showy, makes sense. But we really have nothing to compare this with.
What are chariots used for? Were they used to go to the shops? I mean, what was the general use of chariots in Pompeii?
No, well, I mean, look, you need to bear in mind that for the average Roman, your main form of transportation was by foot. You were walking everywhere. Horses were expensive. They were normally signs of elite social status. But to have a chariot, to actually have a horse-drawn vehicle as opposed to horses dragging along a carriage for freight, to actually have a vehicle for moving people is indicative of very high social status. This is the elite only.
So these were the Aston Martins and the Lamborghinis of Pompeii.
I'm not sure if that's a precise analogy, but yeah, the types of people who own those vehicles are the same types of people in Roman society who would have had a chariot. And particularly a professional one. This is probably associated with someone who's had some degree of military victory, or at the very least some degree of political or public life as well. So I guess in that case, yes, more of a flashy sports car who's showing off is not too dissimilar.
Dr. Barker, this chariot was discovered partly as a result of investigations into illegal digging operations. Look, do we place too many restrictions on archaeology digs? Shouldn't everyone be allowed to have a dig? Because only through these illegal digs did we find this amazing chariot.
No, look, absolutely not. One of the major problems globally, but particularly in areas of conflict such as Syria and Libya, has been an explosion in the black market. These are illegal excavations who are selling objects without context on a black market that are ending up in private hands. One of the big issues with looting of archaeological sites, and particularly tombs, but looting of archaeological sites in places like Italy, places like Greece, is that you are decontextualizing the information. Head of the tomb robbers, or rather head of the robbers who were breaking into this particular villa, and it's a villa that's quite well known. It's called the Civita Giuliana, so it's been known about for some time. The stables were never excavated, and what you had in 2017, 2018 was illegal tunnelling into that area by looters. So you are right that it's unlikely that zone would have been excavated had that illegal activity not have taken place.
Dr. Craig Barker, archaeologist and manager of education public programs at the Chow Chak Museum at the University of Sydney, speaking there with Wendy Searle. And that's all we've got for you on The Wire today. Find all of our stories online at thewire.org.au or subscribe to our podcast. Just look for The Wire Radio. We're going to be back again tomorrow, so do tune in again then. Today's program came from the studios of Radio 2SER 107.3 in Sydney and broadcast around Australia on the Community Radio Network. Wire is produced in Sydney on Gadigal country of the Eora Nation and with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. I'm Roderick Chambers. Keep well and thanks for your company.
Breath, a whole new feeling. Now she says she wants to. I'm only living.